This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We are on remote. We are with Susan Oakey today. She has a new book that's received quite a lot of acclaim, and we're going to hear about it. And first of all, here's Susan with an opening poem.
In the anatomy lab, that night I unwrapped only her right hand and sat, probing to free the lovely network of cables in her palm. Some impulse made her give her body. I didn't know her name or one thing about her life. When I tugged on the flexor digitorum tendons, her fingers partly closed and her thumb crooked in. I seemed to see the two of us as if from outside and could no longer name the tendons. I felt my fingers from inside her hand. Soon I would open the gates of her ribs, would hold even her heart in my palm. Afterward, always home, to feel your palms circling on the small of my back.
You know, Susan, the wonderful thing about your poems is they have a message at the end. Tell us the title of this book and what you think you have said about yourself in this book.
Well, the book is called Woman at the Crossing, and I like that title. It's the title of, I guess it's the title poem, but it was suggested to me that that should be the title of the whole book by David Keplinger, and I'm grateful for that, because I think it's about being at change points during life, all kinds of change. You know, I have poems about parenthood and motherhood. I have poems in which our family lived in Kenya for 3 years, which was a life-changing experience. I have poems about growing up, becoming a doctor, being a doctor, mortality, loss. So all of these are sort of crossings in a way, if you think about these different themes.
Yes. And because you are a physician, a mother, professor, you have been a medical reporter and writer, these are contextualized by the poems in the book. And I think it's really interesting the way poetry frames each part of your life. And so we're going to now hear another poem from these. Give us the title again, Susan Oakey.
I will. This poem is called Slippery, and it's dedicated to my husband, Walter. The hinge, crusted with mud, resists your effort. So you twist and saw, cut through the crack to turn a line into a mouth helplessly opening. You pry the shells apart to show gray flesh glistening in its seawater, and you pass it to me. I tip the bed and slide the cold body onto my tongue, like the afterbirth of a mermaid, salty, so mellifluous that I swallow it whole. Your turn, but you forget. Open me another.
Susan, I had to read that twice before I knew what it was about, before I knew it was about eating oysters. But I'll tell you, the thing that you do consistently is when you bring that poem home, you always make a very subtle statement. And this is a relationship poem. Mm-hmm. This and many of your poems are relationship poems. And I have always felt that a relationship would fail if one person felt she were given more than the other. That's the way I think relationships fail. This is the opposite of that. This is about someone who's giving more than they're getting. Would you read it again?
Of course. Slippery for Walter. The hinge crusted with mud resists your effort. So you twist and saw, cut through the crack to turn a line into a mouth helplessly opening. You pry the shells apart to show gray flesh glistening in its seawater and pass it to me. I tip the bed and slide the cold body onto my tongue like the afterbirth of a mermaid, salty, so mellifluous that I swallow it whole. Your turn, but you forget. Open me another.
Susan Oakey has had poems in journals of great significance, I think, and many of them. She's been doing readings all over the country and has some individual poems that have been prize winners. So let's hear another poem.
Okay, this is a doctor poem, and this poem was in the Journal of the American Medical Association. It's the only one I've ever had in there. It's called A Doctor's Eye, Ignacio's Foot. I know this foot, the sturdy stump that ends mid-instep in a callous knob, the horny yellow skin slammed with each step against the sole of your salted working boot. I remember toes turning dusky like summer plums, the innocent-looking wound launching bacteria to melt your flesh. On your x-rays, infection's shadow crept up the bones till I sent you by taxi to the hospital, where a surgeon lopped off the darkened, rotting half. Mornings since your daughter took you in, you limp beside your grandson to the bus, clean the house, scrape together dollars to pay your fare. Today, you greet me with a toothless smile and show your numbers, high watermarks of sugar in the blood. Tenderly, you unswaddle the stump, present it for my inspection. Look, perfecto. Next time you see me here, I will walk in with a woman on my arm.
Susan, you have had hundreds, if not thousands, of medical episodes. How do you know which one should be a poem?
Well, many of them are just, you know, they're intimate conversations, but there's nothing about them that clings in my mind and sort of haunts me. Sometimes the ones that become poems are the ones that were traumatic for me as well as for the patient, you know, something very difficult that happened. And sometimes there are people who inspire me, as this man did. You know, he had been through so much, and yet his attitude was amazing. He was so upbeat all the time. He was brave. He didn't have the worst diabetes of any patient that we saw in the safety net clinic where I was working, but he just couldn't feel in his feet. And, you know, he got this terrible infection without realizing there was something going on. And that can happen a lot in people who have, you know, loss of sensation in their feet.
Where are the many places that you've practiced medicine in your life?
I was a resident.
From the beginning.
Okay. I went to Harvard Medical School, which is where I met my husband. I went into family medicine in Worcester, Massachusetts at the UMass program. I did the first year of internship there while my partner then, Walter, was at another program in the area. And I got very burned out and depressed in that first year and felt like maybe this isn't for me. Maybe I can't do this. It just seemed overwhelming. It was exhausting. So we moved to D.C. because I had been an intern at the Washington Post as a medical student. I had two summers off, and there was an editor there who kept saying, come back here, we'll give you a job anytime. You know, he wanted me to be a medical reporter, and I decided to do that. So Walter changed his residency and trained down here in Washington. And I went to the Post and was there for a few years in the time when Bob Woodward was, you know, in charge of the Metro section. It was an exciting time to be a reporter there. And that at a certain point after 2 or 3 years reporting, I began to think, maybe I want to go back and try that residency again, you know, see if I can complete it, because it felt unfinished. So I went to a different program in Hartford, Connecticut, and I finished at the UConn, University of Connecticut program. But then my husband decided he wanted to get into malaria research and give up clinical practice. And he joined the Navy in order to do that. And we ended up back in Washington, so I ended up back at the Post again. So it was kind of a seesaw, but I didn't really practice regularly until after I left the Post after 20 years there, and then began volunteering at this safety net clinic in Montgomery County, where my husband is still volunteering. And I worked with patients there for 18 years. And my biggest asset there was that I speak good Spanish, and I had many, many Hispanic patients. And
that is an asset. Yes. And what is your professorship like?
I'm a adjunct faculty member at Georgetown Medical School. And over the years, my favorite thing to teach has been patient interviewing, because, you know, students have to learn how to ask questions and find out about a patient and get their story. So it's a little like journalism, and they're terrified when they start to do it, especially with real patients. So it was a lot of fun to teach that. And then with COVID, we began having to teach it on Zoom, and we began having to have actors play the patients because it wasn't safe to take medical students into the hospital. But the most fun was taking medical students into the hospital.
Well, you've had a rich life. There's enough material for, I think this is your first full-length book. I think you have a lot more, a lot more from these experiences. So that we get more of you at one time, would you read the next poems two at once?
Yes.
Susan Oakey is her name, Susan Oakey.
The next poem is a Chincoteague poem. The poems that I have that are about oysters and the seaside all are based in Chincoteague, where we have a place that we go and spend time at. And Chincoteague is where they have the wild ponies. So this poem is called The Filly. She's not one of those who splay their feet and sink to the ground trying to get away. She stands strong, slender legs under her, head erect on a long neck, looking at the crowd with a questioning eye. Palomino with ragged spots of cream, shining in cloud-filtered light, owning her body, forward in small, smooth steps into the arena, as if two strong men were not gripping her by the chest and haunches. Into the center they urge her, pivot her to face the faces, while another looks for bidders, shouts at a raised hand. The price climbs fast. She's tall, golden, all can sense her spirit. She can't know that beauty, heart, even that pale coat have marked her to become a broodmare on the refuge. Tomorrow, when other foals are loaded into trailers to learn about the bit for some child's pleasure, she'll wade into the channel with the wild herd, swim back to the island with her mother. And a second poem. This poem is for Sally Ride, Sally Kristen Ride. She was my best friend in high school, the astronaut. And this poem is called Within Bounds. When we met, a blade flashed in your eye. Some signal made of light passed through my body. Your father made you wear a tennis skirt for matches. You cared only to move, connect, smash. I'd tag along to watch you explode, chase down a drive, wham it, backhand. And if it fell outside the line, your face and your father's reddened, but no curse, no word, no sound. That game I too could play. I'd trained for it, learned what questions would make my father fall silent, leave the room. So we'd lie on the grass side by side, not touching, talk about the universe's edges rushing away, never about love.
Tell us about Sally Ride.
Sally was, she called herself a proud underachiever in high school. We were at a girls' school together. She was on the tennis team. She was a terrific tennis player. And at one point thought about becoming a professional, but she was a bit too short to have as much of a strong, move from side to side as she might have if she were taller. But she was an excellent athlete. She was guarded. You know, I think we sort of know that from her story as an astronaut. There were many personal things that she didn't talk about. She didn't talk about personal things very much when I knew her, but she loved pranks. She loved jokes. She had a great sense of humor. She had not much patience for pompous teachers or teachers who she didn't like. She didn't mind not working as hard as her father urged her to do. He wanted her to be a real champion in tennis.
It looks like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We both were very close to our fathers, but I would say those fathers, although we were sort of the apples of their eyes, these daughters, they weren't emotionally very expressive. And Sally's family was pretty buttoned up that way. And so was mine, honestly. So we had that in common, and we were very, very close friends. We also loved science, both liked science, but Sally wanted to be an astronomer from the get-go.
Wonderful. What a story. You need to write more about her. The poem is full of that distance between people. It's full of silence, really, and you get a lot of information about relationships here. But did parents of that generation talk about love, though? Did parents of your generation show much affection usually? Or do you think that it was unusual that your parents were kind of formal?
I don't think it was unusual. My parents had been in the war together. That was where they'd met. They'd met in Australia during World War II. And, you know, veterans of that war are famous for not talking about it. They weren't in combat, but they didn't talk about their experiences much. And when it came to, you know, teaching you about the facts of life, you know, when you're a teenager, my mother tried, but she didn't make it clear at all what she was saying.
I know. Mine didn't bother. That's true. That was definitely not a subject you talked about. Mm-hmm. And here you became a physician and learned all about it in the lab. But, you know, I like this poem a lot because it's a character portrait. It has relationships in it. And also it has a complexity because you and the character, the writer and the character, in themselves cannot reach across the chasm.
That's right.
That is wonderful. But yet, lying side by side, talking about the universe is a kind of love.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you believe? There's
a kind
of love, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you do a lot in a poem, and I'm sure you're not conscious when you set out to write it. You just tell the story as you've done. But what comes out with a seasoned writer is a layers of meaning. And I like this a lot.
Thank you.
Also, your poems are really consistent on the page. Do you think you have one kind of energy that seems to form your stanzas exactly so?
I don't know. It is true that there's a consistency across the book in terms of structure. I have one poem that looks weird and different from the others because it's about 9/11, and it tries to create the sense of how confusing and inscrutable that whole day was, you know, the day of the planes flying into the buildings.
But where were you?
I was driving into D.C. on my way to the Washington Post to work when I heard on the radio a plane has flown into a building in New York. And I thought, well, that's strange. You know, it's a clear day. It's a gorgeous day. How could a plane do that? And then, you know, I kept driving and there was another message about a plane has flown into the Pentagon. And I thought, something's happening. Something important is happening. I have to get to work. I have to report this. We all have to get on, you know, into the newsroom right away. Should I yell out and tell people? It was just, you know, we got there to the newsroom and everybody was there and there was no way you could report anything because we had no information. All we could do was watch the building fall down on TV. It was a horrible day.
It was a horrible day. Let's hear two more poems and then I would love to hear about your life in Kenya.
Okay, well, the next one of these is about Kenya. The rains begin in Western Kenya, 1991. All through the dry season, I swallow my tears. I don't sleep, eat without tasting, wander the house without seeing my children. Across the Atlantic, my mother has died. Tunes from the Requiem of Mozart sing day and night in my brain. On the morning the air tastes different, A wind rustles, ignites scarlet blossoms on the flame tree, as if to burn the branches to ash. Giant toads appear like stones, stick out their tongues at the sky. Night, thunder, waterfall of rain. From the lake, flying ants arise into the sky over marshes, villages, drop into the mouths of toads, dogs, children, fill everything that is empty.
And let's hear the next. I think that the next poem also came from Kenya, right?
Yes, it did.
Okay, yeah. Let us hear that one.
All right. On Lake Victoria, 1992, for Peter Ochumba. Above rare fish with gaping mouths, we float, motor dead. The lake's warm as soup, noon light blinking off your glasses as you pull the starter cord. Your goal to save the strange species that live only here. Between us, one water bottle, little fuel, no shade, no paddle, miles from shore, the villages with rough-sawn fishing boats, young men asleep in huts, their flesh melting from AIDS. This lake, a highway for fishermen, smugglers, viruses. You in your frayed hat, a scientist who lacks sample jars, aquarium, your limbs bony too, pretending the weekend funerals have nothing to do with you. Shadow of a huge perch slips beneath the boat. The motor coughs, starts.
What a good character study that is. And what were you doing in that boat?
Well, when I was in Kenya, my husband was working on malaria. My kids were in a little international school there in this town, Kisumu, which was on Lake Victoria, as it says. And I was reporting. I was doing as many stories as I could from Africa for the Post. They had agreed that I could do that. They had somebody covering the war in Somalia, you know, and they didn't have anybody or never had anybody to do just sort of science stories or other kinds of features. So I found things to write about. And Peter Ochumba was a scientist. He was a local guy. He was interested in saving these rare fish that they had in Lake Victoria, which were threatened by the Nile perch, which had been introduced as a fish, an eating fish and a source of income, but they weren't native. And he had a relationship with a scientist in Boston, I think, who came over and would work with him. But no, he didn't really have, you know, scientific resources. He just really wanted to save the fish.
Did he do valuable work without resources?
He did what he could. He would, try to keep track of the fish. I think he needed a lot more resources than he had. But the problem with AIDS at that time in Kenya was really rampant. There were no drugs for AIDS there at that time. They didn't even have any drugs for any of the infections that AIDS could bring along. And so there were just deaths of professional people, doctors, you know, lab techs, anybody. It was all over, and there were funerals every weekend, literally.
How did that change your life living in Kenya?
Well, we had a wonderful experience there. I mean, sad in the sense that there was this terrible epidemic going on, but at the same time, I felt like I was doing something important in finding ways to report on the environment, the lake, you know, AIDS itself. I did stories on that. It was wonderful to have that opportunity to be able to find things to write about and send them off and have them, you know, have people learn about them.
Right.
But we also made close friends. My kids felt a real sense of community there. And I would say that living in a multicultural, multi-race environment like that was a wonderful experience for my children. You know, it was just completely different from race in America, I would say. So, you know, life was tough for a lot of people there, but we made a lot of friends and really got to see a whole other world.
As I say, you have plenty to write about, and you have written two books of nonfiction. What are they about?
One of them I wrote with Sally about going into space. She did a lot of the writing. She sort of collected all the materials because she was the one who had gone into space. I wrote a book about the epidemic of childhood obesity in the United States. I was encouraged to do that by people that I knew in the Academy of Medicine downtown. And it had just gotten attention, the idea that obesity in children was a new epidemic in America, and it's still a problem. So I wrote that book several years ago now.
So you have two different brains, right? Or two different parts of you. What happens when you have to shift gears and go into fiction and go into the feeling part of yourself? How does that shift happen?
Well, I think it happened sort of at the point when I was about 20 years a reporter. I had always been, you know, writing nonfiction and not putting my opinion in, because at the Post we were taught, you know, you give the reader the first chance at the facts. You don't say what you think. You tell us what you've learned. So that was what we did. And but at a certain point, I kind of rediscovered writing poetry. I took a little workshop and I really enjoyed it. And I realized that I wanted to write about what I was feeling. You know, I wanted to have that experience too, and I couldn't have it as a reporter.
And so you did with this book. And what is the title again?
It's called Woman at the Crossing.
And now we're going to hear a final poem.
Okay. Two mothers. Hannah comes in like the sun, gathers up my three-year-old, who laughs to feel her hug. She doesn't grab the baby, Jacob, waits to see where she'll fit in the network of our needs. Maternity leave's over. I want her as my mother. Of her life, I only hear the outline. She fled Cameroon, husband's always working. His mother in Virginia tends their child while Hannah cares for mine. That feels wrong. Not to worry, she tells me. In their culture, it's grandma's job. When Jacob cries, she wraps him in a shawl on her back to ride while she does dishes. Evenings, my breasts aching, I hurry home to nurse, but she can never let him cry when he wants a bottle. My milk dries up, unneeded. Walking one summer morning, Jacob at 2 holds my hand on the lane beside our house. I'm chatting with another mom when he spots Hannah coming. He lets go, runs ahead to greet her. How wonderful, my neighbor murmurs. That's what you want.
The irony and the beauty of Susan Oakey. And this is the program, The Poet and the Poem, from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Production. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, the Maryland State Arts Council, the Ravada Foundation of the Logan family, and the Song in the Room Poetry Workshop. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.